You're listening to the Sound Atlas.
Hey there, I'm your host, Captain Dean, on this episode taped at Spencer's Coffee House in beautiful downtown Bowling Green. I am sitting down with an amazing musician, artist, and a Bowling Green music scene forced to be reckoned with, and he is giggling and licking his coffee as I'm saying all this. He is a true inspiration and a longtime friend, Seth Sprouse. Welcome to the Sound Atlas.
Hey, man, it's great to be here. You really stretched every bit of that out as far as you could take it, except for the longtime friend thing, Dean. How are you, man?
Everybody gives me shit immediately for the things that I'm coming up with.
No, you know what?
For intros.
You do it. You do a really great job of giving a warm welcome, man. It's great. We've been sitting here shooting the breeze for like the past 15 minutes, and it's been a great conversation. Great to talk with
Well,
you.
All those words are true, and I can say that because I have known you for a long time.
Yeah, I've
known you for a long time. I'm going to ask you a lot of questions that I already know the answers to.
Okay.
But I'm also going to try to get some things out of you that maybe I don't know. But we truly go back a long way. And the one thing that I can actually start off with that I don't know is, are you from Bowling Green?
I'm not.
If I'm correct, you are from Florida.
No, I'm not from Florida. I was born in a U.S. Steel Company hospital in Lynch, Kentucky, in Harlan County, Kentucky.
Oh,
I'm from a coal camp.
You're a coal miner.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. My Lynch, Kentucky. But it's actually the highest elevation in the state is Black Mountain, Kentucky. And Lynch, Kentucky is at the very bottom of that mountain at Black Mountain.
I think I got mixed up for a minute because I know your brother Justin and I went to high school together.
Yeah, yeah.
And we spent a decent amount of time together, and I think he moved to Florida.
He did move
so
to Florida.
So for some dumb reason, I guess maybe I thought he went back home or something.
He just liked Florida. I don't blame him. But yeah, no.
Florida has its moments.
Yeah, now he is from Bowling Green. He's born here and everything, but my life started in Lynch, Kentucky.
Lynch, Kentucky.
Yeah, my hometown is actually Cumberland, but Cumberland, Benham, and Lynch is really like, it's three coal camps, all the Welsh and the Italian and the Russian miners. Well, the Welsh and the Russian miners lived in Cumberland. All the black miners lived in Benham, and all the Italian miners lived in Lynch.
Interesting.
So that's another part of Americana and music.
Right.
You know, because a lot of people don't realize this, but, you know, the Welsh had guitars, the Welsh had, you know, the fiddles, the Russian had fiddles,
right.
The Russians had the concertinas and the accordions, the banjo is an African instrument,
mm-hmm.
You know, the Italians had their instruments too, and so a lot of those musical combinations came together in those coal camps.
Right.
And some cool stuff happened.
Do you have memory of that by any means? Or
yeah. I've
how long were you there? Like,
I was there till, but still a lot of my family's there.
Yeah.
So I go there all the time.
Okay.
And, but yeah, I have
memory. But growing up, did you witness any of that?
Growing up, yeah. Yeah. There's music there.
So
everywhere.
Music's
but
been pretty.
It wasn't like
there in your life from day one, pretty
yeah,
much.
Yeah. One of my earliest memories. And I still have the concert ticket. My mom kept it for me in my baby book, but it was a Municipal Auditorium, Jethro Tull Thick as a Brick tour. Man, I was 2 years old.
My God.
My parents would have gone to jail today for some of the stuff that they
that
did.
Cool.
But I still remember bits and pieces of that concert.
Wow.
Because we were on the side of the stage, and I remember that there was like this little house built on the stage. And they were way out in front of it, at the front of the stage, singing. And this guy would crouch down, and behind that house, I could see him. And he would run out and take his guitar and give him a flute sometimes. And then he would run back out and take his flute and take his guitar sometimes.
So
I remember that.
Very theatrical.
Very early. One of my earliest memories of music is Jethro Tull. At Municipal Auditorium.
That's crazy.
Yeah. I still have the concert ticket.
So you grew up in an area filled with music, and you obviously grew up in a family that loved music.
Well, one of them did anyway.
Right.
You know, rock and roll.
Right. So that, answers the obvious second question that usually follows with where are you from, is how did you get into music? That sums it up right there.
I don't know, man. Honestly, man, I
seems
always
like you were born into it.
I always loved it. Always remember singing. Always remember writing little poems and stuff.
So being around it, when did you actually pick up an instrument and get started with learning and developing a craft for it?
Really, when I was 8, but I didn't really do a whole lot about that. I always kind of tried to sing and stuff. You know, I always imagined myself like being on the Mickey Mouse Club or something like that, you know, what I watched every day at home when I was a kid, a little kid. You know, and that tells you how old I am, too, because this is a long time. But
so dated.
Right. But when I was about 12 years old is when I really got the itch to play.
The hankering for it.
Yeah, man. Yeah. And so I got a guitar.
Door.
And, yeah. And
sitting by the...
I had a little, door. You know, little electric guitar at first, and I had a little acoustic guitar at first, and I learned Wipeout.
Oh, wow.
And I learned Pipeline, you know, the little licks. Now, you know, I couldn't play the whole songs all the way through by any means, but, you know, I'd learned those riffs. And then
I learned Peter Gunn.
Peter Gunn, yeah, so yeah, like, Peter Gunn, that's a good
like,
one,
to
yeah.
To me, it's one of those things that's like super easy.
Yeah,
that even a kid that doesn't know how to tune a guitar can kind of figure it out.
Right, and then, I would, at that time in my life, and like, I had good musical influence throughout my life. You know, my mother, my mom was wild as hell. You know, she partied backstage with Kiss and Bob Seger.
Wow.
And Blue Oyster Cult.
Mostly in Nashville, I guess?
Oh, no, all over the place. There's actually a story of her and some of her friends from Eastern Kentucky. I don't know how faux pas this is, but they traded drugs with Sly Stone.
Okay.
At a show in Virginia.
Okay.
And apparently Sly Stone had lots of LSD. His crew had lots
that
of LSD,
sense.
But they had no good marijuana, and so they had good marijuana, and they traded. This is from, you know, I don't know how true this is. This is for a story that my mom told. It wasn't me. It wasn't me. But that's kind of the background. So I always had been introduced to music and things like that. And so when I was a kid and starting to learn how to play guitar, I also had like a big Crosby, Stills, and Nash. I was on Crosby, Stills, and Nash kick for a long time as a kid. And
what year would that be? Like...
This is going back
mid-70s, late 70s?
Oh, man. Like probably like 82, 83, you know, around those time frames. I loved Sting. I loved The Police.
So the new wave thing kind of...
Yeah, it was all over the place kind of, you know. I really loved Crosby, Stills, and Nash. I really loved The Police. I really loved some of the prog rock.
Yeah.
I loved King Crimson.
I've interviewed some people already that were a little too young for this, but you obviously were not. When MTV launched,
I remember that.
Kind of impact did that have on you?
Huge.
And did you have cable and get to see it, or
no,
did you have to go to?
I lived way out in the
like
country, but I had to go. I had to go way out in the country, you know, or I had to go to friends' house because I lived way out in the country, and I did all the time. It was a huge. MTV was huge, man.
I mean, it really
it was a huge deal.
Really made an impact.
Yeah, it did. It really did.
So, again, I've known you forever. So a lot of these I already know the answer to. You're known as a bass player, I think, in most people's minds. Did you start on bass, or what did you actually start on, and what led you in the direction to becoming not necessarily a full-time bass player, but just the musician you are in general?
Simple answer, man. I started on guitar. I love guitar. I've always loved guitar. But when it came to actually playing in a band, which was the only reason to play, in my opinion... Mm-hmm. There was never any question that that was the goal.
Right.
You know what I mean? I don't understand how anybody could do it any other way.
Right.
But everybody already had a guitar player, and they were already better than me. And so I got in, you know, get in where you fit in, man. Right. And I fit in playing bass, and I played bass for a long time. And, you know, bass has been really good to me.
Yes, it has.
And the bass has been really good to me.
I remember the first time I met you, I was probably about 11 or 12 years old. You went to high school with my cousin, Mike Vertrees.
That's right, yeah.
And I ended up meeting you and several other people that we will eventually get to later as we talk. And the first thing I heard about you was you've got to meet Seth Sprouse and hear him play. And even then, even in high school, you were like Victor Wooten style.
No,
yes,
no,
you
Lord,
were,
no.
Because we were all very basic players,
well,
barely being able to learn a G chord, and you were already pretty good at like scales and stuff.
Man, you guys were just gullible.
That. I remember that.
You guys were just gullible, man.
You stood out because
I was faking it till I made it, man. Fake it till you make it.
You were damn good at it. Well, you actually put a lot more time into practicing, I think, than most of us. We were posing like our favorite music videos, and you were actually learning how to play the damn instrument.
Well, I enjoyed that, and I remember that. And about bass, all right, the first bass I ever got, I actually traded my first electric guitar for. The first electric guitar I had, my parents got me, I want to say when I was about 12, maybe.
Okay. Yeah.
All right. It was a Dixon Les Paul Black Beauty copy.
Which were usually pretty heavy.
Oh, they were huge. And it was a beautiful guitar. And, man, I was in love like no other with it for, like, you know, 4 or 5 years. And then, you know, it didn't have a whammy bar. It didn't, you know, it wasn't a Kramer Striker.
It didn't fit in with the
right, times. Right, was right, you know, it was this old-fashioned grandpappy guitar look, you know, and you know, back then, you know, the thing was, you know, the Kramer Strikers,
oh, yeah,
or the Jacksons, Rose, and the Floyd Rose, right, you know, and they were the hot thing.
You're getting the Ace Frehley, Peter Frampton guitar.
Yeah,
I want the hot pink with the Floyd Rose.
If I had to go back again and do it all over again, dude, I would just slap myself, you know, if the 40-year-old old me could go back and say, you've got a rare Les Paul, you know, a lawsuit copy, man, you need to hang on to that.
That's,
you know,
great.
But I didn't, so, but I got a Black Beauty now, so it's all good.
Yep.
But I traded that guitar in for to Thumper Bumpus.
Ah,
all right,
a man that has a song named
that's
after.
That's right. And Thumper gave me my first bass, which you later had it
briefly,
was the Cort.
I remember that
precision
and
bass.
For somehow it ended up in my hands, but I don't even remember
so
how.
That bass, okay,
golly,
this was a crazy story. So that was my first bass. I left it at someone's house overnight after jamming one night that I won't name.
I remember,
and
this
that
now.
Person ended up stealing my bass.
Yes.
And some of my other gear.
And I ended up getting it from a music store.
I think you ended up buying
no
it.
No idea.
From a music store that we won't name,
and
because
you,
they bought stolen
you came
stuff.
Came over to hang out with a mutual friend of ours.
Yeah.
You saw it.
I saw it and I said, that's my bass.
Yep.
And
you
I took
it back.
It.
And rightfully
was,
so.
That, well, no, that was wrong of me to do.
No, no, actually it wasn't, because I did get kind of like somewhat redemption for that.
Oh, really?
Because I bought a hot guitar that rightfully belonged to you.
Well, you know,
I think somehow along the way something was done.
Okay.
To where it was fixed on my end.
Okay. As long as they made
it
right.
And I remember that now. Man, that was a foggy time.
It was, man. That was a foggy time.
But
that was my first bass.
That was no beef between us.
No, but here's a cool thing. We both had, I don't know, the same bass for a while.
Yep.
And it was my first bass. And it was,
I keep telling people, I was like, I started playing guitar and bass long before I played drums.
Yeah.
That's proof.
Yeah, that's proof. That's proof. You're a great drummer, man, by the way. And, you know, great drummers and good bass players, they have something in common. There's always going to be work.
Yeah.
There's always going to be work for you if you
want.
You
would
want.
Think.
Well, I don't know.
It's out
is.
There. You just,
they always
if you
is.
Want it.
Everybody's, you know, it's a real cliquish, you know.
Yeah.
Things
that's
are real
true.
Cliquish, and, you know. I wouldn't be surprised if some people aren't intimidated by what you can do.
I don't know what it is.
I know.
It's been an odd couple of years for me.
Well, I'll tell you what. You know, I mean, I think that the right things eventually fall into our laps.
Right, and I've learned to just kind of quit looking and just wait.
Yeah.
So right now I'm waiting.
There's an old adage, and then there's a new age thing. The new age thing is the universe always gives you what you need. Mm. It's not always what you think you want, but it's always what you need.
Happens when you need it. Yeah.
The old biblical aspect of that is the Lord says, "Be still, and I will fight for you."
There you go.
You know what I mean,
hurricane swirls around you if you stand in the middle of it.
That's it, man.
Let's go back to your 12. You trade your guitar. You get a bass. When did you
get into
you get into your first band, or when did you actually start playing with others and start finding out that this is something you wanted to pursue?
Man, really probably the first deal that I got into was really filling in for your cousin Mike.
And
Minimum Wage.
Minimum Wage, okay.
Minimum Wage.
Now, I remember Mike Vertries, by the way, is my cousin.
Yeah.
And you and him went to high school together.
Great guitar player.
At Warren Central.
Yeah.
And then Greenwood was built.
Right.
And he ended up going to Greenwood the last 2 years, I believe, of his high school years.
And I stayed
at remained at Warren Central.
Everybody I played music with basically got chopped away and went to Greenwood.
That was a weird
time.
That because I met you and Lance Corte and Barry McCandless and Nathan Hale and Marty Tal. I could make a huge list of names that I met. And a lot of you went to Warren Central at the same time. Bruce Penny.
Yeah, Bruce.
So
Elvin Penny.
Elvin Penny.
Yeah, Elvin Penny. His mama named him Bruce. I'm going to call him Bruce.
I'm going to call him Bruce. So what got you in the path of being a musician? When did you get started? What was your first band?
I was looking. I wanted in a band situation bad.
Right.
You know, I think everybody kind of had one already. Everybody
so you
knew
weren't
I could
anything
play.
Prior to that?
I'm trying to think. You know, I jammed around with some people.
But nothing like that.
But nothing
hit
like
the
a
stage.
Because to me, it wasn't a band until you had a show.
Right.
You know, I mean, you're just playing.
Well, were you
you're
ever in a band that like had a name or had something but never left the garage?
Citadel. Now, Citadel played out, though.
Now, I'm glad you said that, and I'll tell you why. Before we got together today to have this meeting, I tried to call Mike to say, was Seth in Citadel?
Yeah.
And I wanted to make sure I was right about that
without
bringing
it up.
I
came up with the name.
But the reason I wanted to call... He didn't answer his phone, by the way. But the reason I wanted to verify that was because Mike was a huge inspiration for me.
Sure.
My brother, Brad, and Mike both were just my idols. And they're a few years older than me.
Yeah.
But
Mike
was hugely influenced by you. And so anything that you seemed to do...
I was hugely influenced by him.
I think it was a mutual thing on both of you guys, but... He would always talk about Citadel. And you know how Mike is. When he gets into something, he gets into it.
You know,
and
I'll
he
take,
talks about it a lot.
Let me back up for a second. Because before I ever filled in for Mike in Minimum Wage, me and Mike jammed a few times in a choir and guitar class.
Okay.
And so, like,
I think I knew that.
And I would go to Mike's house, and we had written like 4 or 5 songs. And, you know, Mike's dad was like, hey, man, those are pretty good.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, your kids, you know, those are pretty good.
And he knows.
He does. He does know. And, you know, he's got a history himself.
Yes, he does.
And
he deserves his own podcast.
That's it. He does, dude. He really does. And you know, so we'd like taped him. We made him on a tape recorder at Mike's house. And then, you know, we played him in choir class and, like, you know, people would dig it and all that stuff. And, you know, even years later, Mike was like, hey, do you remember those songs? And, like, I couldn't remember them today for anything. But, you know, I guess that was, you know, I'd always jammed around with people. But until I really filled in bass for Mike in Minimum Wage. Because they had shows.
They really did.
I don't know.
They played
Knights of Columbus quite a few times.
I went to several shows of them, and it was a big thing for me.
Yeah,
because
sure.
around the time that Minimum Wage was active, I would say it was about 89, between 89 and 91.
Yeah,
like
80,
it was somewhere in
88,
there.
89.
Minimum Wage was active, and those guys were still in high school.
Right.
But they were... powerful enough and talented enough to do not only shows but like a jam-packed 2-hour set
Yeah.
Quality covers.
Quality covers, yeah.
Like, they had good. Chosen
so,
song, yeah.
Minimum Wage was Bruce Penny.
Yes.
Mike Vertrees. Barry McCandless played rhythm guitar, I believe that's right.
Yep.
Oh, who else?
Lance
was?
Corte.
Lance
Corte.
Lance Corte played the drums and Nathan sang.
Yeah.
So it was a great band.
What did Mike do to leave the band, so to speak?
Because I don't know that he did anything. I think that he had two aspirins in his pocket, and his mom was washing his jeans and thought he had drugs and got grounded.
I'm not going to touch that because
I bet you
that's
won't.
Family.
That's right. You buried it. You buried it.
But I think that's good reason. To
I think
it.
That's exactly why. I think he had aspirin. It was literally like Myadol or something
that's
in
hilarious.
in his pants pockets, and she thought he was on drugs and grounded
he
him.
He was apparently on like menstruation.
Yeah, it was like had like a aspirin or
really
something
bad.
And you know he got cut out of that Halloween party gig, and that's what it was. It was a Halloween party on the square. We were all in high school,
right?
It was a wild party that night. Since we're sitting on the square now, I can look over. It used to be, I want to say, Kelly. It's the building that is currently now. I don't know what's in it now,
but Vic's, it's been Brewing Company.
Yeah. And then
Kelly Green,
I think Kelly, maybe yeah. The Twisted Tap, and there were several things that was.
It was too, yeah, that's right.
Along the way.
Yeah.
And it had a beautiful upstairs part of that, which had been gutted, and a nice basement area.
Yeah.
And there was a crazy story about that night, and again, this is, you know, going on the edge of what's maybe acceptable or right, you know, but
it's history, and
it's Bowling Green music history, man. Yep. So Minimum Wage was playing this party on the square. It was a huge party. It was a giant success, and the basement was full of underage kids drinking.
Wow.
We were all drinking.
I'm surprised I wasn't there.
And so anyways, the cops come. And I was actually literally standing downstairs in the basement with my mother. My mom was there. She had come to see me play at this bass gig, right? Mm-hmm. All right. And so there were some other friends. I think, I can't remember who else was there. I think Nathan was there, Barry was there. We were all there. But then Bruce Penny comes running downstairs saying, "The cops are here. We're all underage. Everybody hide." And so we go, like, this crowd of, like, 25 kids,
wow,
something like that, go into this little place where there's a haunted house and there's this black plastic. And then, like, you know, I can imagine, we hear the police come down. We can see the flashlight, like, on the edge of the plastic. We can hear the click clock of his copy shoes, you know, as he's walking downstairs.
Oh, man.
And then he acts like he comes up to the plastic we're all hiding behind, and he starts to walk away. And then he comes back again and peels back the plastic real quick, and he said, "Looky here!" You know, there was a bunch of kids back there. It was hilarious. So
wow, that was your first gig, so to speak?
That was my first gig as a bass player, man. That was my first gig as a bass player.
What year was that? That had to be 91.
No, 90? Lord, no. That was I want to say maybe it was 89 or 90.
Oh, wow.
Yeah,
okay.
Maybe. I don't know, man. You might be right. It might be 91, but I want to say it was like 1990. Or 89
yeah,
or 90.
Maybe. I get a little fuzzy on that.
Yeah.
Because I think by the time I was playing,
it was probably
the
90.
Scene was late 91.
Okay.
And I think he was already out of Minimum Wage at that point.
Maybe
yeah,
true.
That,
maybe true.
Why.
No, that's
I've
probably right.
I've known you forever, but for
it's
some reason I didn't
right.
know that.
No, that's true.
That's pretty
that's
interesting.
Probably, you're probably right. It probably was 91. I can't remember. It was October.
So
it's Halloween. That's all I can remember.
So once you got, did you join the band?
Minimum Wage,
full time,
no,
or did
no,
you just play
I
a few shows?
I think it was shortly after that the Wage kind of floated away.
Right. So eventually.
And that became
that
Citadel. Some
into,
of the remnants of
okay.
Wage became Citadel.
And when did the. I know Nathan Hale.
Yeah.
Barry McCandless.
Yep.
And when did Tim Howard come into the picture?
Tim wasn't there for a while. That
so
was
who was
a
playing drums
so,
with the Citadel?
That was a guy named Jason Eddy. And
oh, wow.
Jason Eddy was a pretty good drummer.
Yeah,
and
heard
he
that
was
name in a long time.
Right. He was gigging in town with a band called Strange Eddy
yeah.
at the time, which is Robert Strange and his brother, Nathan Eddy, and
yeah.
him. And they were a great three-piece. Rob played guitar and sang. Nathan Eddy was a great bass player. Jason was a really dynamic drummer. So he started playing Citadel. We had a few shows. I remember we opened for the Luna Cats a couple of times. Wow. Down on 13th Street Cafe. 13th
was
Street.
Was it already 13th Street?
It was 13th Street at the time. It, no, it was Mr. C.
Mr. C's, I think.
It was Mr.
C's turned into 13th Street Cafe.
Right.
Probably between 91 and 92.
All right. So it was 13th Street because I remember we played with the Luna Cats on Friday the 13th at 13th Street.
Fantastic.
Yeah, I remember the flyer. I made the flyer. It had a big dragon holding the ball and all this stuff. So that I remember. And then the Citadel kind of, you know, we learned about the same stuff. And then, practice was a party every time, you know, so we never really, the work ethic wasn't there.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And so that kind of eventually fizzled away. And then I started playing with these cats. Jeff Downing. Let me see. This is where I ran into Tim Howard.
The 90s are fuzzy.
Right, man. The 90s are fuzzy. It was Jeff Downing, Dave Charlton, Tim Howard.
Okay.
And that band was Grim Reaper.
Oh.
Grim Reaper.
I do remember that.
And so we came along into Grim Reaper, and we needed basically another guitar player.
Right.
And so Barry stepped into that, and it became Genocide.
Okay. I definitely remember that name.
Genocide.
I do remember that.
And it was some heavy, heavy ass metal.
Just like the name Citadel.
Yeah.
You had Genocide, and Mike raved about that a lot.
Yeah.
He was always a big fan of whatever you did.
Well, I was always a
and
big fan of
cool
Mike.
Cool names. I always think they weren't necessarily like hard to come across.
Right.
You know, can look them up in the dictionary.
Exactly.
But in that era, I think, where everybody was getting more and more alternative and more and more Seattle-ish in a way. You guys kind of stuck true to the like heavy rock roots.
It was heavy metal.
It was stoner rock before stoner rock was cool.
It was. Yeah. We did a lot of that.
You guys were really kind of ahead of that game, or at least
Genocide played Thursdays a lot in town.
So that would definitely be like in 93 to 95.
Yeah. And so we saw all kinds of fights go down in that place. I saw some crazy stuff. And Mike was with a band at that time called Angel Fist.
Yes.
And so Angel Fist had a great lineup of players.
Yep.
That was Mike Allen Bays.
Yep. Mark Allen, I believe.
I don't know if Mark
was Mark in that.
Played
no,
with
Todd
that.
Coop.
Todd Coop was
the guitar
there.
Player.
And then
why can't I remember the drummer?
Also, I don't know. I can't remember the drummer either. But
I'm sorry, drummer.
I know that Tim Buckman also played in that band.
Yeah.
Tim Buckman's a great player.
Oh, Tim Buckman.
He's somebody that is really, you know, he's reached out. He's what we always wanted to
do. I feel bad I didn't mention his name earlier when he was part of that one Citadel gang. But,
oh, he was. He absolutely was. And as a matter of fact, one of the shows that Citadel played was at a party he wasn't supposed to have at his house. I remember Tim Buckman had this crazy party that his parents would have killed him for, you know.
I've been to that house, too. That was a nice place.
It was a nice place.
So, obviously, Genocide is what ended up becoming Seven Limbs.
It did. That's where we kind
of
ran
a lot
across.
Of people to this day are going to remember you well with that band. The band lasted for a while.
Oh, it did.
The name was fairly popular because of the era. Obviously, Seven Limbs came along pretty big. The scene was changing.
It was.
Sixth Floor had come along around that point.
Yeah,
I know my band, Tomatoes, was doing it. And we were all kind of in that same category, so to speak, of heavy-rooted rock, very Black Sabbath-y. But with the new stuff coming out in that 90s era, all of us were really into Tool, Rage Against the Machine, and a lot of stuff that was on major labels coming down, trickling down.
I think a lot of people were. I know for me personally, at that time, I enjoyed Tool. I enjoyed Some Rage, but I was really into Jane's Addiction at that time.
Yeah.
I was really still into prog. I mean, my taste didn't change that
it
much
like
at all.
Rush took a change.
Yeah,
like,
Rush.
Even though they were still keyboardy and nerdy, they were still really cool.
They were Rush was that was I think Roll the Bones was out around that time.
Yeah,
I'd
Roll
gone
the Bones
to see
came
Rush
out in,
like five times. Yeah,
I saw that tour.
Rush was a big bass influence. Geddy Lee was a big bass influence.
I think that's the thing. Most bass player and drummers loved and admired Rush no matter what.
Right,
because
I think so.
It was so inspiring. And so they stayed true to who they were, even though they did kind of shift with the tides.
Kind of like the Rolling Stones did that, too.
Right.
You know, another big deal that really influenced me bass-wise and rock and roll-wise was The Who.
Oh, okay.
The Who was a huge
influence. For some reason, I did not know that.
Oh, yeah. I loved The Who, man. I probably... That Quadrophenia album, probably the whole time I was in high school, man, and even to today, I mean, it's on my playlist today.
Right.
That Quadrophenia album was really incredible, and the, you know, the Who's Next album, some of the Who and the way John Entwistle played bass.
Right.
Along with a lot of those drums. And, dude, Roger Daltrey, I'm getting goosebumps thinking about the way Roger Daltrey can sing. You know, if I could sing like anybody,
that's true.
In my dreams, it would be either Chris Cornell or Roger Daltrey.
There you go. Yeah, well, that was obviously leading to a question that's common, is influences.
Yeah.
I knew a lot of them, but I also didn't know that. So I was hoping today would bring some answers of new for me as well as people listening.
Yeah.
What else stands out for you?
For me?
As a bass player.
As a bass player? Yeah. Crosby, Stills, and Nash. Hmm. If you go back as a bass player and you listen to Sweet Judy Blue Eyes.
Okay.
It'll blow you away. Think about the bass.
Never even touched them.
You go back and as a bass player, listen to Wooden Ships.
Okay.
If you go back and you listen to some of these songs, man, they're incredible. They're incredible bass songs. They're really great rock and roll songs. They were really great harmony songs.
Right.
And I think that today, with everything kind of eclipsing back to this Americana thing,
right.
And you know, some of it's kind of sad,
it definitely comes in waves, it seems like.
It does kind of, you know, in the hats and all that stuff. But the Crosby, Stills, and Nash and some of that stuff was, I think, a big influence on some of the stuff that's happening today. Another big, you know, The Who, definitely there. Uriah Heep, I love Uriah Heep. I love King Crimson.
Well, I knew that.
Yeah.
The
King Crimson is still definitely a big influence today. Crimson
is
just... I think
you were the first person I even remember being introduced to King Crimson through, I believe.
Yeah.
I remember there was a pretty good chunk of time. I was around you a lot in my youth, teenagers.
Yeah.
And I just remember thumbing through a lot of your tapes in your car and stuff.
Yeah.
You know?
No,
obviously, you and Barry seem to be really big Misfit fans. And
I liked
that
the
was
Misfits.
A big turn on for
I
me.
Liked the Misfits. I liked a lot of stuff, and it was kind of all over the place, man.
Yeah.
It was.
You were definitely one of the few people I knew that was very open minded.
Yeah,
because I knew you listened to a lot of like classical music.
Yeah,
like, you studied music. A lot of us just studied MTV.
Right.
You actually studied pieces of music.
Well, this is backing up again, all right, because, we talked about guitar and how I got a guitar and everything. And so I had an uncle. He's really my first guitar hero. He just passed away this past year in November, Douglas Sprouse. And he was a classical music lover. He loved Andreas Segovia, and if you look here on my playlist in the A's here, that's one of the ones I have right now, Andreas Segovia.
Yeah.
He was a classical player. He showed me how to hold the guitar right. He showed me how to, you know, he showed me some principles that helped guide me through a lot of things. And so I had appreciation for it. To me, this is the deal, man. There's just good songs and bad songs. Mm. You know, this is genre stuff to me doesn't exist.
Right.
It's a marketing gimmick.
It
you
is.
Know,
to and me, we all fall for it.
There's just good songs and bad songs, man. I love...
And it's all, of course, based on personal taste as well. You
know? I love Hybrid Moments by the Misfits.
Yeah.
I love, you know, who Baba O'Reilly by The Who. I love, you know, there's so many things that I love. You know, and looking on my playlist, the big influences for me back then, of course, you know, Black Sabbath was huge.
Of course.
Because it was bass. You look, Black Sabbath bass is incredible. Black Sabbath is black jazz.
It really is.
It really is.
There was a live album, I think, that they put out pretty early. Or it was maybe a bootleg or something, but I heard it. And there's a moment where they just bust into this, like, full-blown jazz in their sound. And it was like, what in the hell is
that? And that's
this?
In Fairies Wear Boots.
That was crazy.
That's in Fairies Wear Boots where they
break
down like
that. For the first
like
time, and after hearing, you know, Sweet Leaf and all this other stuff, I'm like, what in the world?
Seven Limbs recorded a song called Clover, where we do kind of a breakdown into that and kind of a walking bass line, free form. Barry does a great guitar solo.
I had the first Seven Limbs homemade.
The creepy
like EP.
EP
or whatever.
Yeah, the creepy
EP. I remember that, but I, for some dumb reason, never had Pax Americana.
I got Pax Americana. Americana. And we actually have another album.
You do?
We do.
Okay.
It's called,
that was my
it's
next
called,
question.
It's called Funeral.
You guys released two albums?
Never have
albums?
Released it. We never have released Funeral.
But you released two albums.
Yeah.
There was
creepy,
the independent done.
Creepy EP and then Pax Americana.
Okay. Those two were released. Did fairly well, I mean, on a local level.
On a local
you guys
level,
very,
they did
very active. You played Louisville a lot, I believe.
We did. We played Louisville. We played Nashville. We played as far into as into West Virginia.
Right.
You know.
And Seven Limbs was you on bass, Barry McCandless on guitar, Nathan Hale on vocal, and Tim Howard on drums.
Yep.
And that lineup was Seven Limbs. There was never
there
any
was never
changed
any
out
change
or nobody quit
to
or anything like
in,
that.
For a decade.
Yeah. I was going to say, it did last for quite a while.
For a decade. And we made some great music. That Funeral album that we have is probably, it was a really mature, really, really good album.
Is there any plans to ever put that out?
You know, I would like to.
Kind of
yeah,
a,
I would like to see
all four have to be in.
All on, four have to be in.
Yeah.
You know, all four of us have to be in. And I would really like to see that get released. You know, there might be some question about, you know, the quality of it or whatever as far as sound-wise. But, you know, to me, they were all great songs. And there's great songs there.
It was
and,
definitely a great band.
Yeah.
And I know it influenced a lot of people because I interviewed Cody Meek, and he brought it up, and how big of an impact it was, not only musically as a fan, but just in general, like he said that his band Pilot was able to do shows with you guys, and it was just the perfect fit.
Yeah.
And so you all were
Pilot
part of
really
that
well.
Dominating underground, in a way, I guess, rock scene.
We did do
it. But a heavier rock
it scene. It was a heavier rock scene.
And that was the time when it was very saturated with a lot of lighter things.
There were.
The rock scene has definitely been eclectic.
It
over
has been.
All these years, it's always been full of diversity.
Yeah.
But there's always been, in my opinion, a very heavy rock scene.
Mm-hmm.
It just wasn't always welcome in clubs.
That's a fact.
So it was kind of a hit and miss thing on where you could play.
That's
and
right.
When you played. What did Seven Limbs do in its active years?
Their bread and butter was all ages shows at the Armories.
Okay. Did you ever play at Diggler's?
We did play at Diggler's before.
I thought so.
We did play at Diggler's before.
Any other clubs stick out around
we
that
did.
Time?
We played at Thursdays. We played at the Cobalt Club.
Oh, yeah.
We played, jeez Louise. I mean, we played quite a few places. We
no,
played
there were, I know
quite
were,
a few places.
I remember in, the Armory shows.
Yeah, we played in Glasgow a few times. Played at the Armory in Glasgow a few times. Played a lot with Sixth Floor.
Yeah.
You know?
You guys were definitely together.
Yeah.
I think they came out around 95.
Yeah.
I'm sure you all were already out or somewhat established by
playing.
That point.
And Genocide was winding up about the time that Sixth Floor was getting started.
Right.
Seven Limbs was just kind of being born.
Right. Just kind of
at that time.
Emerged from
and,
that.
And Sixth Floor was just kind of being born. I remember those guys when I remember being at like maybe one of their second or third practices. I don't think they had settled on a name yet.
Oh, okay.
And it was right on right there on off University Boulevard. There used to be a little row of houses wow. behind the Chinese restaurant over yeah. there that is now Walgreens or something, you know?
You gotta love that.
Yeah, yeah. And so, I remember John King had a dog with green hair or something. Somebody died. I think Nick Green dyed his hair. And they had this little puppy. Yeah, man, it was cool. But they were roommates at the time, and, you know, those were wild days.
So, Seven Limbs had a good run, comes to an end. You eventually ended up playing bass in 6-4
for a while.
Kind
yeah,
kind of happened right after Seven Limbs, or did, what you, did you do in the area of the end of Seven Limbs?
You know, at the end of Seven Limbs, me and Elvin Penny played. There was a. This is going back to before Seven Limbs, really, and before the genocide stuff. So it wasn't always heavy metal.
Right.
Me and Bruce Penny and John Capps,
oh,
rest his soul.
Yeah.
We played together for a long time in a band called Planet X.
Oh, wow. And see, we, I remember that name, but for some reason did not know you were in it.
And we did that a lot. We played a lot at Gary's.
Yeah.
If you remember Gary's, oh, we opened for Radioactive Flowers yep. a bunch.
I think I saw you one. I'm pretty sure I saw one of those shows.
So that was all original stuff, and it wasn't heavy metal. It was
no,
lighter.
It was very
lighter stuff.
Yeah, kind of, I guess you would deem alternative.
Exactly.
At that point.
Exactly. It was. Yeah. And that same thing, so after Seven Limbs, what? Not really wrapped up. I mean, we're still doing
right,
the funeral
just,
album.
It
but,
didn't seem to be your permanent thing. You
yeah.
did other things, but it was still
it was really winding
alive.
Down. A lot of those guys were getting older. A
right.
lot of those guys were having kids, you
right.
know? And so, you know, the things kind of started to slow down. And, I mean, so I was
so
me and Bruce got back together. And
oh,
Bruce showed up.
New
this,
gods.
The new gods.
Okay.
Yeah, as a matter of fact, my
you're wearing...
I got Captain Dean merch on, and I got Demand New Gods merch.
That's
on.
Awesome.
So it's a, but the New Gods did really well, and Bruce came to my house one time. He's like, "Hey, man, let's make some music again." We tried to find John Capps again, and that's when we discovered that he had passed away.
Yeah,
and which was a giant loss, man. What a great drummer. I mean.
I knew him,
yeah.
but I didn't know him like personally like you guys did, but I did meet him a few times.
Man, so. He was an incredible player.
Yeah.
He was an incredible drummer. And so he, yeah, unfortunately that had happened. So we had, we worked with Mark Allen for a long time,
mm-hmm.
and even Tim Howard at the end of that.
Okay. I was going to say, yeah. I remember it was you and Bruce. Which
yep.
I thought was cool,
yeah.
because it brought back the minimum wage era for
yeah,
me, because
yeah.
that's where I met Bruce.
Right.
And it was always cool in my eyes to see, at that point, I think, in the music scene and in our personal circle of people that we know,
yeah.
a lot of people were starting to put it down.
Yeah,
and
they were.
And kind of, you know, grow up.
Yeah.
you didn't.
No.
And that was a big motivator for me.
I don't know. So, I don't know that I could. You
I don't
know
think
what I mean?
I've tried,
I don't,
and it lasted about 2 weeks. And,
I don't see yeah. that as a... I don't think I could do that. My soul's not going to let that... I don't know. Just to, because, like, even now, so, you know, I have the Slack, which is really still some of the songs that we played in the New Gods.
Okay.
Okay, so... You know, Bruce helped write
a lot of those.
Probably, yeah, yeah. There's a good handful of those that Bruce yeah. helped write that we still do in the Slack.
Right.
You know, Love Without Homes, one of them. Trudy is one of them.
Yeah.
You know, it's a good song. I'm not sure that there's any more of them besides those. And the rest
of
them.
There's a lot of good songs.
There's a lot of good stuff.
I know you have, that's really kind of your personal
yeah.
baby without, I don't know.
I've got a great, you know what,
that's
I'm lucky that... currently where it's at right now. You know, I've got great people to play with. You know, and Quentin Ferris playing drums, great drummer. Delbert Fields. You know, and as a matter of fact, this is just...
Yeah, there's you're really active now. Like, you're in several things.
Well, I'll tell you what. So, I'm as busy as I want to be.
And that's good.
It is good.
Because some of us are sitting at home looking at our equipment.
As far as that goes, though, yeah. Man, I mean, you know, it's out there for you if you want it. And don't forget, when the Slack started up, who is the first person I thought of?
I know.
Oh, shame.
I was in a position where I thought I'd do it.
Yeah.
And then I had a position or an offer in a way to keep my thing alive.
So right, and keep your thing alive.
Of course you have to choose that.
No, I understand.
But I do appreciate that.
Right, no,
it's
man.
What's funny is I've known you for so long, and we had never...
We've never jammed.
...physically... held instruments together
That's
at the same
right.
time and played music together until you put on a benefit show for Daniel.
Yeah.
And we all kind of got together as friends and to help raise money for him and his horrible situation.
Yeah.
And that was the first time I got to be on stage with you and played music. And it was you and my former bandmate, Marty Tao.
Yeah.
And that was a big moment for me.
Man, it was a great moment.
There was literally nobody in the crowd, but I didn't care. Marty's the world to me.
Marty's a great player.
He is.
He's a great... And, you know, in the early days of me playing bass or guitar or whatever...
That's what I was going to say.
Marty was a
huge
influence.
You all kind of did grow up together, and you almost complimented each other as far as your technique and your style. And you all were very... level.
Yeah. And Marty was a great player. Yeah. I mean, he's got a lot of great music, too.
I know. I was there for a lot of it.
Yeah, you sure were.
Thankfully, a lot of it got recorded, and I'm very, very happy about that. I know a lot of people that never recorded anything.
Yeah, and that's a shame,
every day.
Man.
Like,
that's
man,
a shame. They
got to
get that stuff recorded.
Stack of CDs of everything I've ever done. And I'm that's like my Fort Knox.
Yeah.
You know? It means so much. It's like looking through photographs.
Well, I wish that Planet X had recorded a lot of our stuff.
Yeah. Well, getting back to that, so Planet X kind of came out of Seven Limbs in a way.
It was just before
Seven Limbs kind of started to slow down.
There was this hiatus kind of in between Genocide and Seven Limbs, and that's where
Planet X
came.
And that lasted for a bit. Turns into like the New Gods.
Eventually, years later, it would.
Right. Okay, am I skipping anybody that you...
Well, there was the... It's so crazy because there has always been overlapping projects.
Right.
You know, it's always been. So, you know, going back from really kicking it off between... And this is taking it back for me. This has been an awesome thing for me to be able to kind of remember who I've worked with. The first person I ever worked with writing any music together was your cousin Mike.
Yeah.
My good friend Mike Vertrees. So... That was first. Then, let's say that filling in for him in Minimum Wage, Citadel, Grim Reaper, Genocide, Planet X, then Seven Limbs was kind of how that happened. And throughout the Seven Limbs
period.
That
was like your main thing.
Seven Limbs was the main thing, and then kind of toward the end of that is that was
starting to fold. Because you've always been fairly busy.
Yeah.
I don't recall you ever... I've never run into you and go, what are you doing? Oh, nothing.
Well, yeah.
I mean, you've always had something, even if it was just solo project, working alone. Yeah. You've always stayed active. So,
I don't know. See, that's the thing. It's like oxygen for me,
right.
man. I got to have...
a big part of your life, and... I mentioned at the beginning of this that you were not only a talented musician, you're a very talented artist. And on a personal level, one of the first things that I kind of picked up from you, literally you, like out of anybody I know, your like hands-on designs for not only flyers but maybe album artwork or just ideas in general, you always seem to have an amazing ability to put your artwork and your music together as almost like a package deal. And that had a huge impact on me because I've always been hands-on with album covers and posters. And
well, I've always been impressed about how you do that.
Well, but you were doing it way
before me. I
got your
merch on right now.
You
know what I mean?
Doing that way before me.
Here's the thing about the artwork, though, with me, though.
I mean, it's like Escher quality.
Well, it's not.
It's detailed.
I've had the ability to do that, but I never enjoyed it.
How come?
I don't know. I can't tell you why that is, but I can't tell you how many projects I took on because I didn't want to say no to people.
Right.
And then just let it collapse and burn. You know, and that bothers me that I did that. But when it came to the visual artwork side of things,
right.
That's probably what I was better at than music,
mm-hmm.
but I never liked it.
That's weird.
And it is weird. And then, like, when I was going to Western, that's one of the things that people told me my whole life. You're going to be a famous artist someday. You got to go to school for
Remember, blah, 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 you know, and
that's what I did. You know what? And I did not enjoy it.
That's weird.
I did not like doing visual art. Huh. And I got into these art classes, and there was a handful of people that I liked up there. But I hated
it. But it seemed, in my eyes, it seemed like it went really hand-in-hand with your whatever band you were in, whatever music you were doing. You would always develop something to go with it, as maybe an album cover, maybe just some sort of poster.
I think that was just to save money.
It was just something to do.
I think it was just
But you were good at it, and you did it, because I think deep down you maybe did enjoy it.
I don't know about that, but I'll tell you something, though. Here's something that always impressed me about you, though. Because to me, like, I had all these Grateful Dead posters as a kid, right?
Yeah.
You know, and the artwork was so cool, man.
It was.
It really was. Yeah. You know, and then I heard Grateful Dead, and I was like, what?
Yeah, what?
What? You mean that's the same
thing
that put out that poster, man? How can that poster be so hardcore and badass, and that song be like, Sugar Magnolia, Blossoms Blooming? You know, it's like, what? But see, it was the merch, man. The merch is a big part of that. It goes hand in hand, and you're really good at that.
Because of people like you. I mean,
well, I don't know about that.
On a local level, you are a big influence on me.
So. That's what I need to do more of. I need to have, you know, more the total package. Hey, man, here's an awesome piece of artwork, an awesome poster. Here's an awesome
and a soundtrack to go with it.
And a soundtrack, and it, because it's all expression.
To me, it really is a package thing. I've always looked at the album cover and the inside artwork and everything to go with the music you're listening to, almost as if you're watching a movie,
right?
And the movie poster just sells it.
It's a
big thing for me.
It's a big deal.
So
it should be.
When on a cool note, I don't know if you know this, when the Seven Limbs EP was done, my cousin Mike, once again, we're going to mention him this whole episode. He is the one that printed those.
Yes.
And I would go over to his apartment and help fold and staple
the
covers.
Awesome.
And so we would, you know, every other disc, you'd pop it in to test and make sure they were printing and turning out okay. And so I listened to that EP a billion times.
Oh, man.
And as you would listen to these, you know, it's an EP, it's four songs.
Right.
So it's not that long, but listen to it over and over and over again. And stare at this beautiful artwork that you did for the album cover. And I think that had, because it was around that time that it started to, I started getting into taking pictures and asking people, commissioning artwork.
Yeah,
so
you're really good. You could put great stuff together.
When I got into high school, I took a graphic design class, and that's where I ended up getting to where I am today with flyers and all that stuff.
I did that too. Arthur Robb at Warren Central is a graphic design teacher. I'll always remember him, man. He was a guitar maker and a guitar player too.
Oh, wow.
He was a great... Arthur Robb.
Well, speaking of making stuff...
Someday my eyebrows will be as bushy as his. Maybe, I don't know.
Speaking of making stuff, before we lose this, because this needs to be known, you are known fairly well for making custom guitar straps.
One of the things that I did keep about art that I do dig is leather work.
You're very good at it.
Well, thank you.
Obviously, it sums up in your work with what you do musically speaking.
Yeah.
How did you get into that? And what? Do you promote it? Do you advertise it?
I don't promote it enough. I don't advertise it enough because I'm so busy with whatever life throws at me and I've got to play music
that
I hardly have time
for. It's pretty much a collector's piece.
If you got a Sprouse Leather Customs guitar strap, there's less than 30 of you out there.
You pay $50 for it and it instantly becomes worth about $500.
Well, right? Even a lot of people paid more than that, you know.
Man, I've seen your work, and obviously before this episode ends, and I always ask people to promote where they can find your music and blah blah blah, but look up Seth and look up his art in guitar strap making alone.
Well, there's actually a little album on my Facebook profile.
I knew that.
Sprouse Leather Customs.
It's really cool to look at.
I need to do more of that stuff.
Like
there's just not enough
you're
time.
You're what a bootmaker can do with like rattle skin.
Well, that's
you're kind of doing that with guitar straps.
When I was going to Western, I was working at a liquor store. I was the janitor of the movie theaters for a while.
Yep.
And but one of the jobs I had was at Hackey's, the shoe repair. I was helping to resole high-end boots and stuff like that. And so that's kind of where I got into leather working.
Okay.
And that's where I start, you know, not necessarily tooling leather, but realized that, okay, the way that this stuff is put together and the way that this is done, there is kind of an art to it.
Right.
It's not. It's kind of a feel thing. It's not something you can just put into a machine and crank out.
Took out of that what you basically needed, and I think I'm going
to
try this.
I learned how to do a lot of the stuff like the riveting, the stitching, the finishing, things like that.
Right.
But then the making beautiful things with leather was just the art ability that I had, you know, before, and realized that, you know, it's like a lithograph. You're just carving into leather, and you use tools to make it, and it's a beautiful thing.
Again, it's the thing that intrigues me a lot is the merger of art and music.
Yeah, and those guitar
because
straps.
I very much like put that together as a package thing. And so, of course, you have a beautiful guitar.
Yeah.
And you have an incredible strap to go with it.
It's a
great piece to have.
You need one of those straps,
dude. I don't have one.
You need one, man.
I'll become your spokesperson.
Yeah, that's awesome. I think you just did.
Yay.
You know what, man? This has been a great thing, dude.
Well, we're not done yet.
Okay.
We got a little bit to go because we're missing a huge gap of time here.
Okay.
You played bass in Sixth Floor.
I did.
They've had several bass players
they
over
have.
The years. What number were you?
Oh, gosh, I can't remember.
Because I think Wade England was before
they had,
you.
They had somebody before Dave Shaver. Dave Shaver wasn't their original bass player.
Right.
I can't remember that guy, who he was. And then Dave Shaver. And then after Dave Shaver, I want to say they had Joey Parker.
Oh, okay.
Or maybe, no, maybe
I remember
it was Wade
England.
And then Joey Parker, which is a great bass player. All these guys are incredible
bass
players. And then after Joe Parker, I played with them.
Right.
And that was for a few years.
It was.
And then
and it seemed like you were in that with the on-off Seven Limbs thing.
Yeah. And then on-off Seven Limbs and on-off the New Gods as well.
Oh.
I remember there was 1 week. There was 1 week where I played 8 shows. And it was between Sixth Floor and the New Gods.
Yeah.
And I had 2 shows, Friday and Saturday. Was Sixth Floor. I also had 2 shows with the New Gods Friday and Saturday.
Wow.
And it was the New Gods shows were actually later than the Sixth Floor shows, so that worked out great.
Hmm.
We opened for the Kentucky Headhunters and Blackstone Chariot to Cave City Convention Center.
Damn.
It was Sixth Floor, and then we were done with that by 8. And then so I booked it back to town, and then we played the New Gods, played Tidballs one night and then State Street the next. All right. And so that was 4 shows that weekend. And then the next weekend, I had 2 shows with Sixth Floor and 2 shows with the New Gods.
So you've actually been doing the juggling of multiple projects for decent amount of time.
Long time.
And that leads to, I guess, today, right? To jump out of maybe that era of Sixth Floor, Seven Limbs, and New Gods. would that lead up to modern day activity for you, or is there any bands you're missing?
I don't know. There is one, because me and Bruce and Jesus Christ, what is his name? Troy.
Oh,
Troy. You know who I'm talking about, Troy. Bald guy.
If you didn't say his name three times, I could probably think of his last name. He's a giant.
He's in like every band in the world. Yep. But me and him.
He's in here, and he's in Fat Box.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I'm absolutely blank on his name.
On his last name.
I'm so sorry, Troy.
I am too. I'm sorry, Troy. But we played some jazz stuff for a while.
Okay.
We played some good stuff.
He did the jazz stuff at Mellow Mushroom.
We had some good stuff going on, and we were playing like some Julie London and some Patsy Cline, and we had some Kenny Burrell going. It was good stuff, and then that kind of got
a fun little project.
Started to devolve into show tunes, and nothing bad about that. I think Bruce and Sharby Duke and the Casual Affair is what that became. And they still do that, and it's really cool. But yeah. I just felt kind of, that was one project that I felt that was kind of out of place.
But you did it.
I did it. The other
never
one
been
is
afraid to, like, try stuff.
One thing that I felt like, one project that I felt like was good for my soul. And good for, literally and figuratively speaking, good for my soul. And what really helped me progress as a bass player was playing with the Get Down.
Yes. Which definitely brings us up to modern day.
Right.
So at one point, you get in with Robbie. I think the Swing Tones had just kind of
The Swing Tones
wrapped
were,
up.
Were wrapping up. That was, the Swing Tones were still going, I think, full steam at that point.
They had a really busy couple of years, I know that.
Yeah, and then I met Robbie through Mark Allen. Right,
which is an old friend of yours and mine both.
Yeah,
that ended up becoming a new band,
The Get Down. Right,
which was you on bass.
Yeah,
Robbie Watt on lead vocal, Mark Allen on drums.
Right.
I'm getting good at this. Adrian Hall?
Heil. Now, originally, that band was Mark, Robbie, I think it was Chad Coleman on bass.
Oh, okay.
And,
I know Dave Allen played, but maybe
Coop.
That was after.
That was after. And right. then so
That's
they
right.
said,
Todd
come,
Coop was in that
tra- come and try and come and play bass with this thing, man. It's like soul and funk. And so I was like, cool, man, I'll do that, And so then it was Robbie, Mark, me, and Todd. And we did that for a good long time.
Yep.
And then quite a few guitar-wise, I think, and it would, things would kind of, the wheels would fall off of it, and Robbie would be like, all right, man, looks like you guys are going to have to play in the Swing Tones. And I'd be like, dude, I'm not doing that. I'm not doing it, man. And so
I absolutely begged to be in the Swing Tones, but I didn't want to step on Mark's toes.
No, and
I always wanted to be in a 50s like cover band.
Well, they were really good at it. So, anyways, I was like, no, man, I'm not going to do that. And so, but the Get Down really kind of took off, all right? It was like just by fluke, Robbie worked with Adrian at like Sun Products. And Adrian's like, yeah, man, I play keyboards. And, so he's like, come to practice. And he comes to practice, and good Lord, he's a badass.
Oh, he's amazing.
He's amazing. At the time, I think Adrian had like this Casio thing with speakers in it. You know what I mean? Yeah. It's like, since then, he's probably spent, 20 grand in gear.
I saw a picture not that long ago, I guess, of Quentin.
Yeah.
There's a good shot of him off to the side.
Adrian and
he's got like four
this
or five
rack of boards,
yeah,
right?
Cool.
He was like Phil Collins.
He's the real deal.
Yeah, dude. He really totally is. He's a great player.
So there were a lot of kind of member changes off and on.
There were. The health thing kind of hit me.
Yes.
And then, Dave Allen filled in. Yep. And I think Robbie approached Dave Allen, and I approached Dave Allen, you know, because the Get Down was playing a lot of cool stuff. There was a lot of Stevie Wonders, a lot of Al Green. There was a lot of kind of, it was really kind of involved bass lines.
There's a lot of stuff that Dave would have been familiar with being out of the orchestra.
And that he
Kentucky
could do.
And everything.
Right. So. And so Dave would fill in, and as that kind of went on, you know, two things kind of happened. One, I was, like, really tired through a lot of that time.
Right.
And so
I
was
getting into the details, but you did go through a health scare.
Right.
And so thank God you're still with us today.
Well, thank you for that. I was lucky. But then there was also Wide Open Road.
Yes.
And started playing with them.
Yep. And so, again, another band that had several kind of lineup changes, but Artemis.
Artis Green.
Why do I always call him Artemis?
Because there's another Artemis in town that plays. But Artis Green is an incredible player. Right. 7 years Renfro Valley. The guy has probably five CDs of his own incredible music.
I mean, he's a jukebox.
Professionally recorded.
You can hand him a guitar and he will put on a show.
He's incredible, man. He's incredible.
He's a fantastic.
The only
guy.
Reason he's not famous is because he's hanging out with losers like me. So, anyways.
Well, thanks, man. You kept him from getting in.
So, I had to make a choice, right? I was like, I've got the Get Down. Right. I've got Wide Open Road. I would really like to do something
very
original.
Active in the cover scene, so to speak.
Because, you know, I've got like 30 grand worth of gear.
Yeah.
How do you justify doing that? True. How do you justify having that stuff? You better be out making some money with it somehow. You know, and so that's my philosophy behind that. And plus, getting out and playing that stuff was good. It was great for me.
Right.
As a bass player, as a musician, as for something for personal
growth. I did it for a while, and it made me a great drummer.
You have. Yeah, you
but
did.
But then I always have to tell people, I kind of lost my identity. Because when you're on stage every weekend, and on this song you're Pat Benatar's drummer,
right.
On this song you're, you know, Jefferson Airplane's drummer, on this song you're Genesis drummer.
You know,
like, I would stick to the album. Like I didn't ever try to put an ounce of me in it.
Right.
And I lost my identity, made me force myself to quit.
See,
go play originals.
I look at that in a different way.
Right.
You know,
keeping the originals is important.
Keeping the originals is important, and you've done that. But at the same time, I think that time also made you a full spectrum warrior, dude.
In a way.
I mean, you know, think about it like this too. Look at that. Pressed a lot more into you that you probably wouldn't have otherwise been exposed to, and I think it just makes you that much more valuable. When I was going to art school, all right, when I was an art major at Western for the time that I hated it, you know, but I really love art, I really do, but I did not dig that.
Huh.
But I learned some really cool things, though, and one of them was art is always a product of its environment, okay? And the more I look around and the more I see art through history, I loved art history. I was really good at it.
Right.
I clept out of the final in that class. I had like 104 average, right? So I really loved it. And it's true. You're a product of your environment.
Mm-hmm.
So by introducing all those things into your environment, you know, that really gave you a well-rounded, great... I don't think you're underselling the value of that.
It had its moments.
Yeah,
and I took the good from it.
Yeah,
but I still feel bad about it because I was like in my 30s, hanging out with everybody that was in their 60s.
Yeah, I'm taking the good from it too. So it's like
you're kind of in a different boat, I think, than me. I was strictly like country.
Yeah,
and playing out of the scene, but. This isn't about me. It's about you.
Well, no, I was lucky because now the Get Down, they really were locked down to it's got to be funk, soul,
right.
It's got to be this.
Get Down came out of the Swing Tones, which, again, was very active.
Yeah.
They did a lot of stuff.
Yeah.
And
we got to work with some great players, too. I think
foundation of it.
After Todd kind of fell out and everything wasn't going to go right into the Swing Tones, we found a great player, Scott Hall, that came and played.
Yeah.
Scott was a great player. Scott got busy. After that, we ended up, I invited David Tuck and yes. Sheldon Schaefer to come along.
And
we
didn't
know.
They're still there.
They're still there.
Yep.
You know, still playing.
Yep.
And so, but
and Webb Hendricks is now.
Yeah, Webb Hendricks now playing drums, and Dave Allen now playing bass. So they've got a great lineup. For me, the get down was about, you know, there's six guys in that band.
Yeah.
I've got a limited amount of energy. I've got a limited amount of time.
Right.
I needed to decide, all right, so if I am going to play, you know, with a cover band and I am going to do this to kind of
you made the choice.
Justify,
right.
You know, well, for one, there's kind of, even though Wide Open Road was kind of country, there was a lot of variety of rock and
there
roll
was.
In there.
He does definitely do a pretty broad spectrum, I would say.
Right. And there's four guys in that band and Money Splits Better.
Right.
And then, so that was kind of a cold, calculated dirt bag. I'm going for the money and I'm going to boot scoot and
well,
play
but
country.
Musically,
you know?
Speaking, it makes sense to me.
Yeah.
Like, because
yeah.
I've been in that boat before too.
Yeah.
And,
yeah.
And
then I,
so
I still get to do the slack.
So you left. Yeah, right. So that brings me to modern day now.
Yeah.
And to wrap this up, you left the get down. To join Wide Open Road full-time,
yeah. Yeah.
pretty much. And again, Wide Open Road has had a various lineup changes, but who is in Wide Open Road right now?
Right now, it's a great lineup, man. It's Artis Green. It's Mark Allen. 22-year-old guitar wizard Alex Wells.
Absolutely.
Oh, man, he's incredible. And me.
And we'll mention his band, Surviving Wonderland.
Surviving Wonderland. Great band.
Yep.
So I do Wide Open Road. Have a great time with that.
And then you've got this incredibly cool side project in a way called Rat Salad.
Rat Salad,
which
yeah.
is a Black Sabbath tribute band.
Black Sabbath tribute.
Which is you on bass and lead vocals.
Yep.
Delbert Fields, which fits the Tony Iommi perfectly.
Perfectly, man.
Left-handed SG.
Yeah.
Can't get better than that.
Yeah.
And the a mutual friend of ours, incredible yep. talented drummer, Quentin Ferris.
Quentin Ferris, yeah.
And the three of you have been doing that for, what, 2 years now?
A couple, yeah. We've had a couple shows. You know, it's hard to get everybody together, but, man, right. that is such an awesome project.
It's
when it
and you
really
all stuck to, I think you played strictly the Paranoid album.
We played the Paranoid album. We know some stuff. Like, we also do, like, Wicked World.
I remember
Behind
you
the Wall of Sleep.
Posted a thing like, hey, we're playing tonight, and
NIB,
we added a few more songs.
Yeah.
And I remember NIB.
NIB and we got some good stuff going. So
it's
it'll expand.
And
it'll
obviously
expand.
I love Black Sabbath. So.
You know, but, you know, I've always loved Black Sabbath, too.
Oh,
and
yeah.
There's a deep, deep, deep appreciation for Black Sabbath because it is like black jazz.
Yeah.
And when those guys were growing up, you know, when they were kids and they were getting influenced.
Right.
Really,
there
rock
was
and roll.
No rock and roll.
Right.
And
man.
Lemmy said that best. He he remembered a time when there was no rock and
that's
roll.
That's right.
And all they had was Rosemary Clooney records.
That's
and
right.
Jazz.
Yeah.
And any kind of American blues or jazz or whatever.
And
jazz
that's
what
was
they
the danger,
knew
that
when
jazz,
they were children.
Jazz
and
was the dangerous
and they basically
stuff.
Took what pieces they got in their, I guess by that time they'd be teenagers when Little Richard and all that stuff came in. Chuck Berry.
Yeah.
And of course they took that and just ran with
yeah,
it.
Yeah, man.
But those guys definitely had a melting pot of
they did.
Influences and sound
they did.
That was fresh. Like, I think today we all get things that have been done a million times, or you can compare pretty much every band to something.
Tony Iommi loved Django Reinhardt.
Yeah. That's right.
I mean, you know, there's some credit, but you know, that's not really what you'd never really heard that in Black Sabbath.
No, but you'll hear it.
Yeah.
In him.
Yeah.
You know, influence wise.
Yeah.
So and that again, you're in Wide Open Road.
Yeah.
You're in Rat Salad.
Yeah.
And if I am not mistaken,
yeah.
you took kind of some personal solo stuff in a way, coming out of New Gods songs from years past.
Yeah.
Which turned into at first titled Pisces Avenue.
That's the album.
That was the album.
That's the album.
But I think that's what it was labeled when I first came across it. That ended up becoming the Slack.
Yeah.
And the Slack lasted semi-briefly, but it's also still together.
Still going.
Just you've had some lineup changes.
Yeah. It's just one of those things where everybody's busy and those songs are...
Well, you and Quentin are in too many bands.
Yeah.
So you'll never get anything
Quentin's
done.
Right. Quentin's in a lot of projects. And Quentin, again, you know, I mean, he's a working, gigging, full-spectrum warrior kind of dude.
Dude, man. But he's also in school. And
yeah,
I mean, I tip my hat to him.
Yeah, me too, man. Me too.
He's a great guy.
Yeah, and I think staying busy like that's important.
It is. I mean, when I was his age, and I told him this, I was like, when I was your age, I did the same thing.
I'll say
in two or three bands.
Right, and I'll say this too. That's going to continue to happen. Right now, at my point in life, I'm getting, like, squeezed from the left and right on a few things. And so the projects that I'm in right now are kind of on autopilot.
Yeah.
But when things that are squeezing me stop squeezing me, I'm going to be doing more stuff, man. You know? I'm going
to
be doing
more. That brings me to round this out. What do you see on the horizon, maybe with the projects you're in, but... Anything else out there that's going on?
I see taking a cue from you, man. I see. Yeah, man.
You want to sit at home and watch TV?
No. I see something that you do really well that I'm like, you know what? Dean's got something really good cooking.
What do I got?
You got this great sense of merch and identity, and you got this cool thing. And so... You're your own brand, man. You got your own tribe. You know
my
what I mean?
Own Old Navy.
You got a tribe, dude. You got
a
tribe.
And
that is something that anybody who understands value of that is really impressed
by. Well, but you need to understand from my perspective that's people like you. And believe me, like I said earlier, a lot of our peers that we have grown up with and played music with have put it down.
Yeah,
and moved on, and you know, a lot of them do that, but a lot of us are still able to continue to do this and live a normal life, be adults, have children, pay our bills,
not die of drugs overdose.
Exactly, a drugs overdose.
Drugs overdose.
But you've inspired me, and I'm thrilled that I've inspired you.
Check this out, man. High five, fist pump, man.
I don't want to make too many noises.
Right.
Make smacking sounds on the microphone.
Pow. No, that's awesome, man. You know, and you're awesome. And, you know, as much as you get down and get around and pat other people on the back, you deserve a big one yourself, you know.
Get down, pat around, and boot scoot boogie.
Boot scoot boogie, get down. That's what I'll be doing pretty soon with Wide
Open Road. So the future is still holding true with what you got?
Yeah,
Wide
man,
Open
I
Road,
think so.
Rat Salad, and Slack.
I don't see any reason for that to change, you know what I mean? And, like, I've been invited to do way more than I can do.
Of course.
You know what I mean? Yeah. And I think over time I've just gotten real
gotten
picky
better
about
saying no.
Yeah, in a nice way. And also, you know, sometimes you got to network and you got to help other people find who they need.
Right.
You know? I mean, sometimes people think they need you for something and you can't do that.
Right.
But you can help them find who they need.
True.
You know, I think there's been a few times where I was like, hey, Dean, why don't you play bass with these guys?
Yeah. And I would say no politely because in my heart it didn't feel right.
Things like that have to feel good. You know? But I'll tell you this, man, nobody has as impressive a repertoire of cool art, merch, recordings, and stuff as you.
Well, again, it's because of people like you that have inspired me.
Well, I'll tell you what, that's really nice of you to say. But that's also inspiring to me.
That's great.
So in the future, I think, to kind of wrap this deal up.
That really sums up our music scene, though.
Yeah.
It is rooted deep with a lot of history.
Yeah.
A lot of diversity.
Yeah.
And a lot of us are friends.
Yeah.
And I think what you just said could be said about many people. And I've talked to several people.
Yeah.
When I was handed the torch to do this podcast, a lot of people are asking me, who are you going to contact? I would say your name to a lot of them. Oh, yeah. Yeah, you got to talk to him because he's got a lot of history.
Well, there's a lot of people.
So you've inspired a lot of people.
There's a lot of people that you can talk to.
You've inspired a lot of people, and I appreciate you doing this today. Thank you for your time, man. And thank you for everything you've done for our music scene.
Well, it's been my pleasure always. I had a blast, you know.
We'll see you out there on stage, brother.
All right, man. I'll see you there.